answer. Thank you very much, Peter. Firstly, has everybody got a handout? Who's got a handout for this talk? Excellent. Okay. Oh, have you got them? Oh, you have?
No.
Super. I ate muesli for breakfast. Now that statement could be either true or false. I suspect that whether the statement is true or false is of no interest to you. And you're probably thinking, so what? Why does it matter? So it seems that self-interest trumps truth. On the other hand, it might matter if it provides you with some useful information. So, for example, if you're a researcher working out maybe something about breakfast eating habits, then the truth of whether I ate breakfast, whether I ate muesli for breakfast, might be of some importance to you. So pragmatism trumps truth. There are some statements you might prefer to be true, such as, you are the wittiest, most charming person in the world. And there are other situations in which lying might seem preferable to truthfulness. For example, when your best friend comes and says, what do you think of my hairdo? So, lying can sometimes attain one's desires and avoid unpleasant situations. So preference trumps truth. There are other statements you might prefer to ignore, such as those about millions of starving children or the state of the economy. You might argue, A, there is little or nothing you can do with these facts. B, knowledge of the plight of others can be psychologically distressing, and therefore, C, it is better not to know. It could be argued that lying trumps truthfulness in terms of usefulness in desire fulfillment. Desire fulfillment trumps non-desire fulfillment. If there is no objective truth, then truthfulness does not matter, and therefore, truth elimination trumps truth retention. Furthermore, it is possible to construct arguments for the elimination of truth, such as, no one knows what truth is or where it comes from, so it is unexplained, unanchored, and mysterious. Truth is a relative concept. The widespread notion of objective truth can be explained without resorting to mysterianism. The concept of truth is a human construct. The human construction explanation trumps any other because it is more preferable and useful than the non-testable and non-provable theory of objective truth. Therefore, objective truth is a redundant myth. The beauty of the human construct theory is that if truth is merely subjective, then the notion of truth binds us if and only if we allow it to. The problem with these arguments is that despite Hume's assertion that reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions, the world does not conform itself to our wishes. I accept that there are psychological and political advantages of believing in the myth of truth. However, I will argue that denying objective truth, whilst possibly psychologically protective in the short term, is in the long term destructive. But first, I will present an alternative view for why truth matters and my objections. In their 2006 book, Why Truth Matters, Benson and Stagroom argue that we are the only species for whom truth matters, and the only species we know of that has the ability to find it out, and thus we have a kind of duty to do so. I take issue with their claim that the duty is imposed by no one. If it is true that we are the only species for whom truth matters, and the only species we know of that has the ability to find it out, then no moral imperative logically follows. As Hume tells us, we cannot get from an is to an ought. Benson and Stagroom counter Hume's objection by asserting that we are the kind of creatures for whom truth matters. For whom matters of morals, of values, of justice, of ought rather than is, are of greater importance than facts. I concur that there does appear to be some evidence in favour of this view. On the other hand, it could be that what passes for moral behaviour is in fact motivated by self-interest rather than concern for others. Either way, I do not think their argument sufficient on its own to overcome the logical problem. Benson and Stagroom attempt to knock down all the logical arguments for skepticism and relativism by asserting that just about everybody already knows that they are false and know it in a visceral, primal, almost physical way that precedes reflection. To justify this claim, they say, as we move through our daily lives, we rarely question the epistemological status of those things we take to be more than probably true. And we hold beliefs of this kind in a they are true all the way down to a bottom sort of way. And beliefs that we think really certainly true, rather than just probably true, trump other fuzzy, maybe true, maybe false beliefs we hold. I concede that it is true that we don't doubt something, for otherwise it's difficult to explain why we can confidently get out of bed in the morning without worrying whether the floor will hold our weight. However, it does not follow from our natural scepticism in some situations that we can always readily distinguish between truth and error. That Benson and Stagroom's argument is motivated by preference for self-interest rather than preference for truth is shown by the argument presented in their final chapter. And I quote, "We have to think that there is something in order for inquiry to be genuine inquiry and not just an arbitrary game that does not go anywhere. We like games, but we also like genuine inquiry. That's why truth matters." Surely this is the worst kind of argument. It is an argument justifying their desire for inquiry rather than a careful survey of empirical evidence. It is true that some people do indeed like inquiry, but not everybody does. Hurrah if you're an intellectual. Too bad if you're not. This is the kind of emotivism which breeds prejudiced thinking. This is the kind of self-interest-based thinking which can motivate some groups or individuals to kill or oppress others. Given that warfare technology has advanced to the extent of actualizing weapons of mass destruction, self-interest-based thinking is more harmful than ever before. Indeed, it could result in the annihilation of our species. Now, it might be objected that I am scaremongering and that no such threat to our species actually exists. I accept this objection because when I say could result, I do so as a kind of prediction based on my understanding of the available evidence. The truth is that I do not know what will happen in the future, and I know beyond doubt that it is true that I do not know. This certainty does not come from feeling it in my bones or from wanting something to be true for preference of self-interest. Instead, it is derived from the rational weighing of evidence, including the evidence of my personal limitations and of the many false opinions that I have previously taken to be true. For all my criticisms of Benson and Sagram's argument, they raise an important issue. If points of view are given greater consideration than evidence, then injustice follows. They say, and I quote, "Too much attention to points of view with too little skepticism can get innocent people convicted of crimes on the basis of people with points of view but no evidence. A number of US court cases dealing with putative recovered memory, satanic ritual abuse, and child abuse in daycare facilities have achieved just such a result in the past two decades. Law enforcement officials and juries were solemnly instructed to listen to the children, and long prison sentences were handed out to people who were not, in fact, Satanists or child murderers. The dangers seem obvious, but not everyone sees them." This is a well-supported argument based on evidence rather than preference. However, Benson and Sagram fail to build on the danger they have identified. It is a sad fact of our world that there are numerous situations in which points of view do trump evidence and injustice follows. Before I present some examples of these injustices, let's try a thought experiment. So I want you to imagine you have been accused of some crime and you're now on trial in a courtroom facing a jury. You know that you have not committed the crime you are accused of. You know this with absolute 100% certainty. The jury, on the other hand, do not know whether you are guilty or not. They were not present at the alleged crime scene. They have to return a verdict and are thus forced to guess on the basis of the statements presented to them. The jury returns a guilty verdict. You are undeservedly labelled a criminal and punished. Perhaps you are sent to prison and ordered to pay court costs and compensation to those who falsely accused you. How do you feel? Do you feel you've been treated fairly and reasonably? I doubt it. I think you would feel that you had been treated unjustly. I think you would feel that you no longer had control of your life and that you had no means of righting the wrong done to you. I think you would feel that your freedom, reputation, and assets had been stolen from you. I think you would feel victimized. You could argue that it is impossible for you to know how you would feel because you have not experienced that situation. Implicit in this objection is the idea that knowledge is grounded in personal experience. I respond that for my argument, it is sufficient for you to imagine what it would be like. Of course, I'm presupposing that humans are the kind of creatures with the capability for empathizing via imagination. Art proves the empathic faculty of Homo sapiens. Perhaps you could argue that it doesn't matter what it would be like because you would never be in the situation of being falsely convicted. You might argue that those accused of crimes must have done something to justify the accusation. You might cite the argument, "There's no smoke without fire." That argument is a fallacy. A survey of cases brought to trial shows that anyone can be accused and found guilty. Consider, for example, the case of solicitor Sally Clark, who was convicted in 1999 for killing her two sons after they both died suddenly within a few weeks of birth. The prosecution relied on the testimony of a professor of pediatrics who stated that the chance of two children from an affluent family dying from sudden infant death syndrome was 1 in 73 million. The figure was calculated by squaring 1 in 8,500 as being the likelihood of a cop death in a similar circumstance. Despite the Royal Statistical Society issuing a statement arguing that the statistical evidence was flawed and expressing concern at the misuse of statistics in courts, Clark's conviction was upheld at first appeal. The conviction was overturned at second appeal in 2003, after it emerged that the prosecution's pathologist had failed to disclose microbiological reports. Subsequently, the Attorney General ordered a review of hundreds of other cases of alleged baby murders, and other women had their convictions quashed. Sudden cop death syndrome is now a recognized condition, and thankfully, parents whose babies have died tragically are no longer persecuted. Here's another example. Victor Nealon spent 17 years in prison for attempted rape because he resembled the victim's description of a man with a pockmarked face, and he could not provide a watertight alibi. His conviction was quashed after DNA evidence indicated another man was behind the attempted rape. Thomas Kennedy served 9 years of a 15-year sentence for the rape of his daughter. His conviction was overturned when the daughter confessed to falsely accusing her birth father in order to cover up her sexual relationships with her boyfriend. These real-life examples, and you'll find many more, just cruise the internet, there are loads of them, show that it is not necessary for there to be a reason for a conviction. It is sufficient for a jury to believe the accused is guilty, even if there is no evidence to support that belief. Would you want this to happen to you?
No.
No, thank you. The probability of being falsely accused might be very low, but it does not follow that it could not happen. If I'm correct, then surely it is in our best interest to stop this from happening. That's why truth really does matter. It matters because the person being falsely accused could be you or someone you love. It matters because you would not want others to judge and punish you for a crime you did not commit. It matters because you do know it is true, even if you would prefer it to be false, that you could be falsely accused. You know this because there is abundant evidence. It could be objected that our current system of trial by jury is the best means for safeguarding society, even if a few innocents are undeservedly punished. I respond that political expediency does not justify concealment of truth. Furthermore, if punishing innocents doesn't matter, then the concept of punishment is undermined. Moreover, the best of the currently available is not the same as the best. Improvement is possible. It could be argued that those who have been harmed by others deserve retribution, and that this need trumps the harm inflicted on the falsely convicted. I respond that an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth philosophy is self-defeating. Healing does not come from harming of another. Two wrongs do not make a right. Miscarriages of justice result from too much attention to points of view and insufficient skepticism. Miscarriages of justice occur when people believe they know the truth, when in fact they do not and cannot know. We cannot know truth simply by feeling it in our bones, nor can we get to truth by examining evidence, because when we evaluate evidence, we inevitably do so in the light of our personal experiences, preferences, and prejudices. It is not that the truth is not out there. The person falsely convicted knows that their conviction is based on false assumptions and not true statements. If we want to find the truth, then we must examine our personal prejudices. We must, as Socrates said, know ourselves. This is the methodology employed by Descartes when he set out to establish firm and lasting foundations for science. Descartes discovered the following. A. Truth can be attained by using a combination of senses, memory, and intellect. B. The will extends further than the intellect and can be extended to things not understood. C. Errors occur when judgments are made without a clear and distinct understanding, including an understanding of the will as a source of errors. D. Humans are habit-forming creatures. E. By combining A to D, by attentive and often repeated meditation, it is possible to acquire the habit of remembering to abstain from making judgments whenever the truth of a given matter is not apparent. Therefore, it is possible to avoid error. René Descartes concludes his meditations on first philosophy with the statement, "Man is apt to commit errors regarding particular things, and we must acknowledge the infirmity of our nature." Furthermore, he asserts a moral imperative. "I should never judge anything I do not distinctly, clearly and distinctly understand." It might be objected that Descartes' moral imperative is simply asserted rather than argued for. Furthermore, it might be argued that there is ample evidence in support of the view that the human faculty of judgment is selectively advantageous. Moreover, it could be argued that humans are the kind of creatures that make judgments, and thus it would be unnatural for us to do otherwise. Perhaps for Descartes, these objections are irrelevant, because what matters for him is establishing something firm and lasting in the sciences. In other words, he seeks satisfaction of his ambition. Surely, personal fulfillment is not a good enough reason for justifying the claim that truth matters. I concur that truth probably, but not necessarily, matters for science and inquiry. However, I think the groundwork for science is not the only reason, and certainly not the most important reason, for why truth matters. Science may have aided our understanding of the natural world, but has failed to provide a better understanding of human nature, or to offer protection from the recklessness of other humans. It is a sad fact of our world that the exploitive and egocentric side of human nature is not generally acknowledged. This acknowledgement is especially important in law courts, where revenge and the possibility of compensation can motivate false accusations and result in false convictions. Humans judge each other without clearly and distinctly understanding the consequences of their actions. Look at what's happened following the false accusations of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It may be true that humans gain pleasure from inquiry. However, hedonism is not a sufficient reason for endorsing the view that truth matters. Truth matters because we do not want to be undeservedly punished. Truth matters because we do know that individuals are being unnecessarily penalized. Truth matters, because we are not safe. We know any one of us could be undeservedly convicted. Truth matters, because we could prevent injustices. That is why truth matters. Descartes, Benson, and Stankland are correct to say that we have a moral duty to discover and reveal the truth. The duty arises not because we want it, or because we like inquiry and get a biochemical kick from it. Rather, it arises because although we might want to deny it, we do know that we have moral responsibilities towards others. We know this by examining the evidence in conjunction with our faculty of imagination, rather than by feeling it in our bones. We know our current ethics are less than perfect, because we can imagine a better scenario, one in which everybody is treated fairly and no one is undeservedly punished. Ignoring truth in favour of personal preference is dangerous for both ourselves and others. That is why truth really does matter. Thank you all very much. So, any questions? Yes, Bob.
I could hardly disagree with anything you said there. Except the implication that when the jury gets things wrong, they are somehow putting aside the idea that truth matters. Are they just wrong in the sense that they think truth matters, but they got the wrong answer as to what the truth is? And I find the idea that somehow they don't, or people in general, don't take truth seriously, is an unnecessary assumption. Behind all those miscarriages of justice you just outlined.
That's a good question. Thank you very much, Bob. I think...
Would you mind repeating the question, please? It's hard to hear if you're behind.
Oh, yes. Do you want to repeat it or shall I?
I'm just asking whether...
I'll repeat it then. Okay. So the question was for... In the case of the jury, what Bob is asking, he's saying that they don't take it that truth doesn't matter. They've simply got it wrong. It's not that their belief is that truth doesn't matter. Okay. Is that correct, Bob?
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you. So I think, yes, I think maybe the jury are thinking that truth does matter. But if they really thought that, and if they really thought about the truth, then they would be wondering when they're presented with the evidence, they'd be sitting there saying, is that bit of evidence true? And then we wouldn't have cases of miscarriages of justice, because the jury surely would have worked out which statements were true and which were not. No? They might be thick, yes. Well, it's true, they might be thick. But I think there's the bigger problem that goes outside that then, which is how do we get people to understand the truth?
Is the jury being, is there being presented with two different statements from the defence and the prosecution? They have got to make a decision based on their own opinion, basically.
Yes.
So who is telling the truth? If either.
Yes. Yes.
So, truth matters, but how are the jury to get to it?
Well, and that's the point about the injustices that are being done. So my argument is that, I'm not saying that we take out trial by jury altogether, but I'm saying that we need to think about putting improvements in the system to ensure that these injustices are not happening.
Well, this isn't just trial by jury, is it? I'm involved in death row states, and quite often it's down to the judge.
Yes.
One person.
Yes.
Who is making the decision of life or death in cases.
Yes.
Based on, quite often, false evidence.
Yes.
I agree to his letters, but how do you get at it?
Well, how we get at it then is firstly by not thinking that we can just get to the truth straight away. Okay, so it's Benson and Stagram put forward this argument that says that we can get to the truth by somehow feeling in our bones. We know when something has that ring of truth or not. And what I'm saying is that what we need to do is we need to go another step further from that. We can't get to the truth just by that feeling it in our bones. But what we need to do is put into play the faculty of imagination. We need to imagine more what it's like to be that other person. And that will then help us, I think, to see maybe a little bit more about people's motivations and things. We cannot know what is in somebody else's mind. So we need to make sure that the evidence is really robust. And I think that's where the problem lies. If we look at, for example, the Sally Clark case that I quoted, you know, we went on statistical evidence. Is that robust evidence? No.
Sorry, but it didn't go by statistical evidence. I nearly drove off the road. I'm a statistician. Hearing that verdict, I nearly drove off the road saying, this is statistical rubbish.
Yes.
So, it's not, don't blame statisticians. They were presented with expert opinions. Juries are not experts. They have to accept expert opinions. They have no options.
Okay, but then... Yeah, I accept that point, Mike. But then the expert person who put themselves up as being the expert, the pediatrician, how did he get to his statistics? You know, that statistical evidence shouldn't have been...
He understood statistics. He believed he understood statistics. His was an absolutely honest conviction that he understood statistics, and he didn't.
Sorry, Mike, I didn't quite catch that.
The professor in question thought, quite honestly, that he understood statistics in question. His understanding was insufficient. He was not trying to deceive. He was not wrong according to his understanding.
But he believed that he had the truth. That was his problem. Right. He believed that he had the truth when in fact he didn't.
Yeah, but how was he to know that?
How would he have known that?
Yeah.
Well, he would have... That's, yeah, how would he have known that? Well, yeah, it's that's the point, that the statistical evidence shouldn't have been used.
Well, no, it should have been used on the contrary, but this evidence was supporting Sally Clark, actually.
I can hardly hear you, Mike, I'm sorry.
Statistical evidence was actually supporting Sally Clark. Statistical evidence is perfectly respectable, but you have to understand the science. And the trouble is that not everybody can be an expert in everything. But therefore, just imagining what it is like for other people doesn't help that.
You're misrepresenting the court procedure. The court doesn't simply hear the evidence and just, even if they do wonder if it's true. Every piece of evidence, and the more damaging it is, the more this will be true, is subject to cross-examination. The problem was not that one side brought forward a statistical so-called expert who gave a poor judgment of the odds. The damage is that the counsel for the other side didn't bring forward an expert to contradict him.
But
the court process is really quite well adapted to getting not merely what the witnesses say, getting at the validity of what the witnesses say, and the cross-examination is a vital part of that.
Right, but my argument isn't actually about what goes on in the court. My argument is about the underlying thing of why truth matters. And what I'm trying to say is that it matters because unless we really get to the truth, and it's about understanding that we have that difficulty in getting to it. As Mike says, yes, I have no doubt that the pediatrician who presented that bit of statistical evidence really believed the evidence he was getting to. But the point is that belief wasn't sufficient to get to truth. And the point I'm trying to make is when we go on evidence which is not sufficient to get us to the truth, that's when we do serious damage, like I seriously believe happened in Iraq with the false accusation of weapons of mass destruction. Yep, gentleman in the back.
I would like to slightly spin it around in terms of the context of truth and miscarriages of justice. Because truth and miscarriage of justice. My view is, if you take, for example, Jimmy Savile, the truth was avoided about Jimmy Savile, and it's a miscarriage of justice when you have criminals who don't have to face the truth about what they've done, and they haven't been punished for it. Equally, when you talk about the false perspectives for the war in Iraq, it may be the case that there's a miscarriage of justice in that people aren't held accountable for what actually happened. And I think in society, there's probably far more miscarriages of justice where people actually don't look at the truth about people that perpetrate different types of evil. And I think it's quite interesting that there is an avoidance of the truth about certain people. There's lots of bad things happening in the world, and they're perpetrated by individuals, but they're not held accountable for it. For some reason, they're not made to face the consequences of the truth about them.
Right, but my argument isn't about whether people should be held accountable for the deeds that they have done. The argument is more to do with the long-term consequences. So it's about, instead of seeing things in the short term, it's about looking at what happens if we ignore the truth. And the truth is that we cannot get to the truth in a simplified way, whether we're using the courts to do it, whether we're using statistical evidence to get to it. That doesn't get us to the truth. And we make that mistake when we believe that we can get to the truth using these mechanisms. So it's about the harm that comes as the long-term consequence. Sorry?
In criminal cases, that you would have to prove a case beyond reasonable doubt. There is built into the system the fact that the truth may be fundamentally elusive. In a civil action, it's on the balance of probability. Because to actually know absolutely what the truth is impossible. If that was the case, nobody would ever...
And that's my point, that we cannot get to the truth in that way. And it's what happens ultimately. I mean, how would you feel? You're then put in front of the jury. And you can't defend yourself because...
If somebody stole from you, how would you feel if you couldn't take the call and get them punished for what they've done?
Well, that's the argument that says two wrongs don't make a right. Mm-hmm. Harming somebody else isn't going to make it any better for you. So we need to be aware that truth ultimately snowballs out. When we lose sight of it, when we ignore it, this is about what happens when we ignore truth, not how we get to it, whether we use statistical evidence, whether we use the courts, or whatever as a way to getting to it. It's about what happens when we ignore the truth. Yeah.
This discussion about crime and punishment just moved me to Dostoevsky and his book Crime and Punishment, basically, where and I want to ask you, because I think that truth is contextualized and depends as well on different conventions that are in place in a different moment.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, he believes he is doing something right as big characters of history. However, he is convicted. And the problem here as well is that each one is reading the truth from a different perspective, and that makes it even more difficult. So truth is not just unique in that perspective, it's dependable in the eyes of the reader of the truth.
I agree with you totally. Truth as we take it generally in our everyday life is very contextualized. And so what I've tried to do in the argument is to set out what is happening, that we're arguing on the basis of preferences, of the kind of world that we want. We're arguing on the basis of pragmatism. And that gives us a notion of this contextualized truth that you're talking about. You know, people are saying that, you know, you don't want somebody to steal from you, so we feel we need some sort of system in. But what I'm trying to get to is what happens when we ignore the notion of objective truth, that there really is a truth out there, because the person who's falsely convicted, he's the person who knows he hasn't done the crime. The jury are just guessing. Right. So the truth is out there.
You're begging the question. You're saying the person knows he's innocent.
Yes.
That, he doesn't. He's only got memory. That's no more reliable than anything else. The truth.
Yes.
There.
Now, that's a good point, Ben. That's a very good point. Because you could indeed say that the person who is falsely convicted did in fact do that crime and doesn't know that he did it. But that to me seems like a rather strange sort of argument. I agree. You can argue that somebody doesn't know.
But all we're going to have is the best possible, most likely opinion. Your inner conviction that you genuinely didn't murder somebody doesn't mean you didn't murder it.
Right, but how would you feel if you had been convicted of that murder that you know?
I'm sure there are people who have had some sort of mental whatever and been convicted of things they've really done but don't believe they've done it.
Well, what about Sally Clark? What about Victor Neilton? What about the three cases I gave you? Do you think that those cases were...
I don't know the truth in any of those cases.
All
I know is that the most likely reasonable thing, given as much evidence as we can, and we could keep searching for evidence forever and still agree with the conclusions you've come to, and still be wrong, in theory, because the events have happened and gone. And there's no access to them, except fallible human memories.
Well, the two men I quoted here, you've got one case where the daughter then goes, actually, my dad didn't do it. And you've got the other case where we then get the DNA evidence, and that proves that the chap didn't do it.
The daughter was genuinely confessing rather than just some brain sort of anything. All you're getting is more and more plausible. You can't get to an absolute. We know for certain that.
And that's my point. We cannot get to it. But if we ignore it, it's about ignoring that thing that there is truth out there. And
what
happens? Sorry?
You're saying that all these people were ignoring, and it's been mentioned by the people in the audience that no, they weren't ignoring it, they were just getting it wrong.
No, I'm not saying that people were ignoring it. I am saying they're getting it wrong. But I'm saying that they're getting it wrong because of the way that they've handled the evidence.
Is this the word ignore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that not mean your discussion is really about the process of justice?
No.
Not about truth, which you appear to take as an assembly of facts, which can be known or not known?
No, I don't see my argument as about the process of justice. I see it's about arguing for the actual value of truth, why we should value it. We should value it because we see ourselves as being other people, as being able to identify ourselves with others. That's why I think truth matters. It's because it shouldn't be just about self-preference. It should be about other people. So it's got that moral dimension in it. That's why I'm saying truth matters.
You're emphasising that the harm that can be done when justice is miscarried by some innocent person being convicted, but justice can also be miscarried by a guilty person being acquitted, and the two go together very closely.
Yeah, but
you're only emphasising the one where miscarriages of justice are caused by an innocent person being found guilty.
Well, the argument isn't per se about miscarriages of justice. So if I presented it as that, then I've clearly not presented the argument very clearly. The argument is about how we get an understanding of truth whether we're doing it for self-preference, whether we're doing it for pragmatic reason. If we're doing it for pragmatic reason, are we doing it on the basis of self-preference, or are we doing it on an understanding of the totality of how things are for other people as well?
We have questions now, otherwise the next thank you. Thanks very much for coming.